Welcome back to the show. So excited to have you tuning in for a new episode. This episode, I'm talking about the five things I learned in medical school that were completely wrong. And I presented this at the Medical Student Forum on Female Sexual Medicine this last weekend. And I thought it was so interesting that I would share it over here. All right, let's do it. Welcome to Health by Heather Hirsch, a podcast dedicated to uncovering many of the women's health issues many of us are wondering about, but few of us are talking about. My mission is to expose the current gaps in knowledge and care on all things women's health. Enjoy. I have some incredible news in the Health by Heather Hirsch world. I am expanding my telemedicine practice. Yes, that's right, with new states and new providers. This is all starting in February of 2024. If you want to be first to know what states I'll be open in, definitely head over to my Instagram at Heather Hirsch MD. There's places where you can sign up for my email list, and typically I'll be discussing all the new openings in my Instagram stories. If you want to see me as a patient, I have a license in several states, and I would love the chance to work with you and help you to thrive again. You can, again, go to any of my social media handles at Heather Hirsch MD or head to my website, heatherhirschmd.com. I'd love to see you and help you thrive in 2024. Oh my goodness, there's so much going on in my world right now. I am growing my telemedicine practice. I am growing my healthcare course for providers, and it's Wednesday, so we've got our healthcare provider live session tonight. And on top of all of that, I sometimes tend to forget that I have a whole family and kids who need me. And last weekend, we went to Niagara Falls, and I hadn't been there in a really, really long time. I actually forgot how beautiful it was. And my kids were just so in awe of the falls, and it was beautiful to see. And I was meeting two of my very best friends, from one from medical school and one from residency. They both happened to be urologists, and we were talking a ton about medical school and residency training and women's health. And that's because I was so honored to be asked to give a keynote talk at the fourth annual medical student symposium on female sexual health and female sexual medicine. This was really exciting for me because medical school and medical training, it's no surprise if you're an avid listener to the show, or if you just, you know, have all of a sudden gotten into the world of midlife and perimenopause and menopause, how many gaps in care there are. And the biggest offender of this, truthfully, is education. I don't think it's necessarily that doctors, young trainees don't want to learn this. In fact, if anything, seeing all these medical students take, you know, several hours on a Sunday to learn extra, like bonus information. This isn't like in their curriculum. This isn't, I don't think, anything they're getting tested on. I mean, please let me know if I'm wrong here, but they just are craving this information. It's just not routinely taught in schools. And for it to do that, it's just going to take so long to get into the curriculum. And that is because it's not that easy to decide what medical students are trained on. There is just a plethora of information, and the American College of Graduate Medical Education, or the ACGME, is the authoritative body of, you know, people, doctors, clinicians, I don't know, who sit down and decide what medical students should learn. And, you know, again, every single year there is so many new things coming out. There is different priorities. There is different health crises. You know, it's really very much shaped by so many political, cultural, social things. But midlife and menopause care really, truly is not at all in the conversation, nor is female sexual medicine in the conversation. And this is why I am so excited that I launched my course for providers, because I do see that there is a growing and strong interest among clinicians, whether they're young or seasoned, to learn or relearn all this information that they never really got during training, which is particularly perimenopause and how the decline in hormones affects chronic health, particularly hormone replacement therapy, the safe and efficacious forms that can be used under evidence-based guidelines, female sexual health, genitourinary syndrome of menopause. There is just so much to learn, and women are so, so excited to learn this. So I was sitting in my hotel room overlooking the falls and was setting up this talk. And I had 20 minutes to talk to the medical students. And as I was thinking about what I wanted to teach them, I thought about the top five lessons from medical school that I took away that were wrong. So I think I called it, you know, the five kind of big takeaways where there is an obvious gap in women's health care. And the first thing is that women's health is not just pregnancy and contraception. Now, around here, if you're an avid listener to the podcast and you follow lots of doctors who talk about perimenopause and menopause, this is not lost on you. By no means is this like, oh, wow, Heather, I had no idea. I know that you already know that. But it is really important that we teach that to our young minds, our young medical students, right? Average age of medical student, it's gearing a little bit slightly more older, but typically it's still going to be between the ages of 20 and 30, and probably more like 26 to like 32 is probably now the average age of a medical student. So therefore, it's unlikely that most of those women have gone through perimenopause or menopause. Now, we know there are definitely such things as premature menopause, early menopause, surgical menopause, and yes. But again, for the majority of those young women in medical school and men, let's not say men aren't interested in this topic. There are men who are interested in this topic. So please excuse me if I, you know, am saying women when I mean I'm trying to be inclusive, but don't read into it too much. But they're not in late reproductive stages. And, you know, I always tell my story of I always wanted to take care of women. It was just something I intuitively felt and knew about me. There was an interest in women's health. I mean, women's bodies are still very mysterious. And still, you know, even having had three children and three births and having more pregnancies, you know, but there's just so much to learn about the female body, about the hormonal, you know, ups and downs. I was just always so fascinated. And so I thought, well, the only way to do women's health is to go into OBGYN. There's just this sort of razor focus that only OBGYNs take care of women. Now, to no discredit to OBGYNs, of course you do. This is my podcast and my personal experience, so you're going to hear my personal thoughts. But truthfully, it was so fun to attend this symposium because we had a PMNR and rehabilitation physician. We had dermatologists. We had neurologists. We had psychiatrists, all of whom specialize in women's health. And myself, I am now an internist. I did a year of OBGYN, and I realized that I really much loved helping women make complex decisions. I loved sitting. I loved talking. I loved the nuances. I really wanted women to feel confident in their decisions. And that did not match up to running around, doing surgeries, delivering babies, being up in the middle of the night. And so, you know, what I wanted to do is really tell these young minds that if you want to take care of women, there is more than one way. And when I was young, when I was at 26 or 27, when I went to residency, I would have never known that. You know, I always say I didn't go to medical school saying I'm going to be a menopause doctor. In fact, if you're not new to the show, you've heard this story before, but before the Oprah panel, which was last year, I was backstage with Drew Barrymore, and she said, looked me up and down and said, why are you interested in this topic? Because, you know, she said you look to be about 40, which, you know, she did the math. She was right. And I said, you know, this is the biggest gap in care. After we have children and after those children become one, two, or three, and we're no longer going to reproduce, like this gray zone between internal medicine and OBGYN, where no one really has a great grasp on it, is the biggest gap in healthcare. And we can see that clearly. We can see all the companies that are coming up. We can see all the products that are coming up. We can see all of the, e-commerce around it. So much stuff. This is the biggest gap in care. And it's really was important for me to relay that to those young minds. You don't have to go and deliver babies or prescribe birth control if you're interested in things like female sexual medicine or female mental health or even postpartum outcomes. This can be done via the internal medicine. Again, not to dissuade anyone, but I just didn't know that. And so after I changed from OBGYN residency to internal medicine is where I started doing a lot of teaching and I found this gap in care. Then I did my fellowship training at the Cleveland Clinic in 2014 with my mentor, Dr. Thacker, who I always credit with, you know, for teaching me everything that I know and giving me all the experience that I've had and shaping me to become the doctor that I am, along with all the other clinicians that I rotated with during my fellowship training. But I could not believe that women were flying from all over the globe to come to Cleveland to figure out what was this crazy, mysterious, unnamed thing that was happening to them. And, you know, hormone therapy was so dangerous. How could they get to this underground railroad to get, you know, FDA approved patch of estrogen and a pill of progesterone? And it was the eye opener that changed the trajectory of my life. So I never said I'm going to become a menopause doctor when I was a first year medical student. I said, I'm going to be an OBGYN. I love taking care of women. And certainly now you kind of know where I am. So I always say now I don't deliver babies anymore. And that was wonderful. And that was great. But I get to help women like be rebirthed into the best version of themselves. And it is truly the most satisfying and addicting kind of career in medicine. The second thing that I learned that was completely wrong in medical school that I now know is that hormone therapy is safe and effective. I'm not going to spend too much time here on this bulletin point because I certainly have several other podcasts dedicated to this and YouTube videos dedicated to this and all across my social pages dedicated to the safety and efficacy of hormone replacement therapy. But it is a good time to remind, you know, the young medical students or the young trainees of, you know, the story I learned in medical school, which was in 2006, you know, the menopause lecture was, well, hormone therapy is bad. It is kryptonite. It's going to kill women. Don't do it. Have a good rest of your day. And that was the message that we learned about menopause. We never talked about hormone therapy in medical school, never once, except for that 2 second, like, don't prescribe it. I never heard about it in my OBGYN residency. Now, granted, I was there for a year and a half, so I was doing a lot of obstetrics. But again, that residency is very heavy in obstetrical care and surgery. There's just so much to learn in obstetrics and surgery that there's not a lot of time for the medicine aspect, even though traditionally nobody owns menopause, but, you know, OBGYNs sort of feel like that falls under their umbrella. And you can kind of see why, but it is more of a menopause is more actually of a chronic thing. I don't want to call it a disease. I don't want to call it a syndrome. I don't want to call it a symptom, but it's more chronic. It's more chronic management, menopause. And so it actually really fits well in internal medicine if we can get internists comfortable with things like HRT and knowing what to do about a little bit of bleeding. Not that big of a deal, not that hard to learn. But, you know, historically, perimenopause has not really fit nicely into either one of those practices. And I've said this a million times and I'll say it again, but menopause, especially in a large academic center, is de-incentivized because it is not a procedure. It does not make money. It takes up a clinician's time where they could be doing other procedures, delivering other babies or in the OR for our surgeons, our OBGYN. So it is deprioritized and there's actually no incentive for a doctor to have long conversations about menopause. Now, internists, on the other hand, that's our whole job is long conversations. But if they haven't had the training and they're kind of worried about bleeding and not sure what to do and feel uncomfortable on their own, you know, again, herein lies this conundrum of where there is this gray zone, right? So number one, my first point, women's health is not just pregnancy and contraception. The biggest gap in healthcare is in midlife and hormone therapy is safe and effective. And I truly hope that medical students are learning that, although I don't think that they are. I did so much education when I was at Ohio State and at the Brigham and Women's Hospital, and I've given tons and tons of grand rounds and taught lots and lots of residents, and their eyes just bulge open with like interest and excitement when they learn about,
women taking HRT having reductions in cardiovascular disease, reductions in diabetes. Your cardiologists and your endocrinologists are like, what? Reduction in bone loss. Even the psychiatrists, those little budding doctors, are so interested to hear its impact on mental health, on mood, on memory, on processing speed. You know, students are so interested in this information, and I really do hope that they're getting better education than mine, which was, again, the HRT's kryptonite. This conversation is over. The third thing that I medical school didn't really teach me very well is that cardiovascular disease is the leading cause of death in women. Now, let me explain. Certainly they did. Certainly, I think I would have known on a test that the leading cause of death in women was cardiovascular disease. But the way emphasis is placed on breast cancer, right? The way that society has really made that to be the most disastrous or the most, you know, horrible outcome a woman could have, it really plays with your mind. It's just like you always know, like, oh, I logically know this, but in my heart, I feel this. It could be about anything, right? And the same thing is true about the logistics of women's health. Cardiovascular disease is by and far, 20% of women will die of heart disease. And a very small percentage of women will actually die from breast cancer each year. And I think this is not just medical school's fault. This is society in general. And again, this is not to say, it's a little awkward to talk about because I know there are many of you who are breast cancer survivors, or that is a fear. And it's not to discredit that. I don't want anything to happen to any of my patients. But of course, as of right now, there is no, you know, cure for death. And if you are going to look at public health, you know, 300,000 women will die each year from cardiovascular disease. Around 40,000 women will die from breast cancer. And I think that 30,000 is underrepresentation because a lot of women will either not have autopsies or there is no great cause for death and it's likely cardiovascular disease. We also know that cardiovascular disease is, you know, very acute. A heart attack is deadly, whereas breast cancer is now also thought of as more of a chronic condition. You know, if it is caught in an early stage, it is 95% treatable. Doesn't mean that that treatment is very fun, and it doesn't also devalue that, you know, one is not better or worse than the other necessarily. But you have to step back and look at the logistics. Cardiovascular disease is a leading cause of death in women. And we know that hormone therapy, when started within 10 years, decreases the risk of cardiovascular disease. Why does that not make people more upset? That is probably one of the big reasons a lot of us menopause clinicians and doctors constantly are screaming on social media, is because that is a hugely important fact that has gotten washed away with the messaging that HRT increases the risk of breast cancer, which has been debunked. And we don't teach this to medical students. We have so many young doctors who want to become oncologists because it just seems like the best way to help women, right? Breast cancer, boobs. But we actually have a lot about breast cancer figured out in terms of protocols. We have made amazing, huge strides in decreasing mortality. And incidence, unfortunately, is actually increasing. More women are diagnosed each year because our screening modalities are better. We're detecting it too early, potentially. In fact, maybe we've overdone breast cancer and we've gone into the doing more harm than good. We need more women cardiologists who understand how estrogen can be beneficial for cardiovascular disease. Now, to be clear, hormone therapy is not FDA approved for the primary prevention of cardiovascular disease, and it's not used the way it was in the 80s and 90s because of the WHI. But with enough pushing and with enough fighting and with enough evidence, potentially, maybe somewhere way down the road, if I can kind of just like wipe away all the steam, not that the FDA is going to approve it, but maybe more doctors are a little bit more aware of it in the best case scenario. Point number four, female sexual medicine is complex. Now, I was there because I was giving the talk on female sexual medicine. And so I, you know, wanted to really kind of tie this part in here. And this is another interesting point where there is this gray zone between internal medicine and OBGYN, right? OBGYNs, I respect them so much, but again, they're heavy training, or at least when I was an OBGYN resident, on obstetrics and surgery. And I don't think there'd be that many that disagreed with me. If you did want to learn a ton more about sexual medicine, you'd have to go out, go to the ISHWIS conferences, find a mentor, do research, maybe do a fellowship. And then internal medicine, right? Really good at chronic health diseases, chronic management, chronic issues, you know, long-term medications and their side effects. But then when it comes to anything in the pelvis, they're like, nah, I stay away. I consult OBGYN. There is this gray zone. You know, when I was teaching these students, I pulled up the list of medications that can decrease libido. And it's like a page and a half long. And as an internist, we're used to prescribing all different types of medications, you know, whether it's anti-seizure medications, MS medications, medications for autoimmune conditions, for cancer. There is just a long list of medications, and then comorbidities, and then psychiatric conditions, and then pain conditions, and then neuropathy and nerve conditions, and then sleep disorders, and then partnership and trust issues and intimacy issues and long-term relationships. And thinking about sexual health as just how does a, you know, the very minimum of like, how does one penis go into a vagina? It's just so simplistic. It is not the story. You can start there and think about anatomy and pain and trauma and start there, but then you've got to pull that scope out, and that really is going to cover so much more of internal medicine, of psychiatry, of chronic health management, maybe even including pediatric, you know, trauma as a kid, sexual health trauma, etc. And so it is so complex. It really takes a diverse team. It really takes a really good look at someone from like literally all 180 degrees. So female sexual medicine is extraordinarily complex. It is not just about one thing. It is often about multiple things. And point number five, 90% of what we learned about women's health, women and men, is based on the idea that humans are men. Let me kind of say that again. Most of what we learned about being doctors was 90% based on humans being male. And again, this is just to point to the fact that it's things like how does a decline in our sex hormones, right? It's such a disservice calling them sex hormones because they do so much more than help us reproduce. What does that decline do to our mental health? To risks of dementia, which people are studying right now. What about our sexual health? What about our risk of, I just kind of already tapped into cardiovascular disease and diabetes and weight changes. I mean, we could go on and on and on. But 90% of what we learned about medicine is based on humans being male. Studies were done on male. Medications done on males. It's almost like the whole story needs to be rewritten. And I don't know that we're going to have the time in our lifetime to do that or to see that. And we're trying. And everyone is trying. And there's so many amazing people who are really kind of putting this message out there. And young clinicians who are loving and learning this. And I commend all of those medical students who were there that morning because they are the future. They are the future. They're going to reshape how women are treated. They're going to train more doctors who are going to train more doctors, and they're going to train medical students because they remembered this med student symposium on a random cold Sunday in January. And if you are ever feeling like you are being gaslit or you feel stuck or you feel frustrated, it is because of that fact. It all goes back to, truthfully, medical school and then, you know, residency as well, but it's really in medical schools that we could teach this. Residency is where we would need to implement it. And so I'm so passionate about this. And I hope you took something from this podcast episode, a little bit more of a rant, but, you know, just my thoughts here on how, again, we are living in a really exciting time. We are living in a time of uncovering all of the inaccuracies, all of the mistakes. We're uncovering all of the ways in which, you know, we could do this better. Medicine could do this better. The ACGME could prioritize these things better, but it is going to take time. It's going to take advocacy. And that's why I call you my AOWs, my army of women, because you are making these changes. And my healthcare providers, if you are just, you know, you want to switch career paths, you want to focus on this, you've been on the fence, join this class because you're going to join a sisterhood of women and men who are focused on midlife and women's healthcare, because women's health is not just pregnancy and contraception. Those things are important, but we have nailed those down. All right, guys. Thank you so much for listening into the show. I'd love to know what you think. Definitely send me a message over on Instagram. I'd love to see you as a patient. Oh my gosh, we get to do this for an hour, just one-on-one, and then we get to diagnose you and start you on your treatment regimen and help you feel confident and help you thrive. If you are a healthcare provider, you can join the course. If you're not in one of the states that I'm licensed or the collaborative, which is the name of the practice, as we're adding these new doctors and adding these new states, you can always take the Reclaiming Menopause Masterclass, which is also on my website, heatherhirschmd.com. That's going to teach you how to get exactly what you need from your doctor and then teach you how to teach him or her a thing or two along the way. I'll see you guys next time for a brand new episode. Love you so much. Thank you guys, as always, for listening to the show. If you love the show, you're going to love my new book, Unlock Your Menopause Type. This book is really meant to help you identify and target and therefore best treat your most bothersome menopause symptoms. In the book, I go through all the different ways menopause can be treated with HRT, of course, non-hormonal therapies, and diet, exercise, and lifestyle. You can get the book anywhere books are sold. And if you are so inclined, please leave a book review wherever you bought your book. I will absolutely be thanking you. I hope you enjoy reading it as much as I enjoyed writing it. If I haven't already done so, thank you. Thank you from the bottom of my heart for listening to my show. Consider subscribing so you never miss an episode. Also, if you love the show, your stars or a quick review could really help other women who are searching for information on menopause and midlife around the globe find this show. If you want to work with me, consider the Reclaiming Menopause Masterclass. The link for that is in the description to this show. Thank you again from the bottom of my heart for all your support, and I'll see you next week for a brand new episode.